Everyone, thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, asking the question, why wait for heaven? On 1-2 Radio, changing the way we experience life and spirituality. Today is September 18th, 2015. On today's show, I'm happy to welcome back writer, web designer, and ACIM teacher Bruce Rawls. Now, recently, Bruce had suggested to me a series of recordings, workshops that he was listening to that were given by Ken Wapnick, and it's called A Transition in Perspective. And these talks were based on Chapter 16 of the ACIM textbook, and specifically Section 6, which includes the idea the bridge itself is nothing more than a transition in the perspective of reality. And so I've been listening to these recordings, and so has Bruce, and I don't even know how many hours they are, maybe 5 or 6 hours. But in any case, I've only listened to about the first hour, and it is such incredibly powerful stuff. I mean, I can just feel it's just really moving me. It's really provoking me. It's really making me think. And that's just the first hour. So I can hardly wait to hear the rest of it. And I have a feeling that even though that's the topic for today's show, we may be building many, many shows off of these recordings or some of the ideas that are contained, because there's just so much good stuff. I mean, I was just kind of glued to my earphones when I was listening to this stuff earlier in the week. So I hope you will enjoy our discussion about it. And while you're listening, please join us in the 1-2 Radio private group on Facebook. And you can get there if you haven't been there before by just going to the 1-2radio.com website. And on the left side of the page, click that chat button and you will be automatically redirected to our private group. You can ask to join, and that guy at the door ready to let you in is our producer, Scott Weaver. So thanks for being here today, Scott. So let's get going on a transition in perspective. Good morning. Welcome, Bruce.
Good morning, CA. Thanks for having me on your show again.
Hey, thank you. And I absolutely love the topic that you selected for today. And I also just want to thank you for turning me on to these recordings of Ken's, because I'm so enjoying these recordings. And wow, I mean, you know, at the risk of sounding corny, I truly was listening the other day and I said to myself, why do I listen to anything else? I mean, it was just, well, it was such powerful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just so incredibly powerful. And I know that there's a reason that we do other things, like we watch TV or we're, you know, we want to distract ourselves. But that's exactly it. It's about distracting ourselves. And when I was listening to this, I thought, oh my gosh, this is just such incredibly powerful stuff. So thank you very much for suggesting this today.
Oh, certainly. My pleasure.
Yeah. Wow. I'm just like, and Ken, what a jewel. I mean, what a gem. That man is just, you know, so incredibly brilliant. I wish I'd had more opportunity to take classes and workshops with him. You know, I wish I'd been taking more initiative when he was alive.
Well, I can certainly relate to that. I feel, though, that he would be the first one to chide us, since I am one of the ones who, in terms of in-person meetings, wasn't able to actually physically meet Ken while he was, you know, around in form. But I feel like his the legacy of what he's shared is you know, ever stronger. The more I remember to, like you say, you know, give that an emphasis and to you know, dive deeper into the incredibly prodigious work that he shared, and all of it's great. I sometimes joke with people that I'm in the Will Rogers school of Ken Wapnick's work. Is you know, I never met anything that he's done that I didn't like.
Right.
And because it's just brilliant. It's just all brilliant. And it reflects, I think, the deep understanding and appreciation of the, you know, like he says, you can't really get too far from the metaphysics of the course. because that's really where we find the peace that we're all looking for, is in that awareness that there's nothing outside our mind. There's nothing outside in the so-called real world that we call the real world. Anyway, of course, Miracles has a different definition of it, but the real world that we think we're in terms of conventional usage, is what the Course calls a dream. And that's, I think that's the kind of ties into, if I can make a little segue into the topic for this session of, you know, the transition in perspective, is we can slowly but surely shift our identity and our awareness to one of the dreamer rather than the dream figure in the dream. And that, I think, that transition really is what gets us home, what gets us out of the quagmire that we call our life in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what turned you on to this particular topic or to this series of recordings by Ken?
Yeah, I listened to a whole bunch of his recordings, and I just happened to be on recent, daily walks, listening to that through my phone and headset, and the Transition in Perspective series of Ken Wapnick's, and I just found it really, really potent. Particularly right at the beginning, he talks about the myth of Ariadne and the Minotaur and the labyrinth, and I think that's a topic that we could probably spend the next hour on in various aspects. But the primary idea in that is, to tying into that Greek mythology, is that, you know, the labyrinth really is sort of a symbol for this incredibly complicated system that we've devised, which Ken also refers to as the outer shield of oblivion, you know, the material world that we spend so much of our mental energy firefighting and taking care of the next thing that comes up and crossing things off our bucket lists and our laundry lists and our lists of lists. And, you know, I'm getting ready to move across, halfway across the country, or a third of the way, I guess, across the country in next week. And so I've got my lists of lists, and then I keep thinking, well, I should be adding this to this list, but that's the whole strategy of the ego, is to keep us mindless by keeping us so preoccupied with things happening in our projected world, and keeping us from keeping cognizant of the idea and the fact that this is a projection. Mm-hmm. That ideas don't leave their source. That there really isn't a world outside of us. And that's why one of my favorite quotes from modern physics is from a physicist named John Wheeler, who says, "There's no out there." And so even in addition to the ancient mystical wisdom and things like the Advaita Vedanta, and more contemporary, ideas like the Course in Miracles, which obviously we're focusing on here. That right along, that the whole idea that this is an illusion isn't a new idea. What Ken adds to it is that it's purposive, and he's reminds us that the Course adds that is that there's an intention to everything that we do, and that intention is either one of the two thought systems or one of the two threads tying back into this labyrinth myth. The labyrinth being this vast intricate network, and the Greek mythology was on the island of Minos, and hence the Minotaur, or the bullheaded demon of Minos that basically led into the labyrinth, or was the monster waiting in the labyrinth. And there's this dark thread that we follow into the labyrinth, which is really a symbol for the ego's strategies and thought system and dictums and this whole idea that we somehow need to flee from the light. We need to get away from the oneness that is so simple and devise a world of complexity. And we apparently seemingly have pulled it off.
Boy, have we.
and talk about convincing, another, bunch of adjectives I like to remind myself of when I get engrossed and entangled mentally with my identity, tied up in this world, is to to realize it's an incredibly convincing, photorealistic, three-dimensional, holographic projection of my unconscious mind. And the only way for me to undo my experience that is less than wonderful is to disinvest and deinvest, whatever the right word is there, to let go of, you know, my investment in the idea that the paradigm of sin, guilt, and fear is real. And that's the inner shield of oblivion that the ego doesn't want us to look at, and it's reflected and bolstered by the outer shield, which is really the first line of defense that the ego has of keeping us mindless. And the strategy, one of the primary strategies for doing that, and which fits in with the idea of duality, is fragmentation. And so as we go deeper into the labyrinth, we find all these branches and forks and you know, if to use a stream metaphor, rivulets and tributaries and all these things that get further and further split apart. Just like, you know, if you picture the branches of a tree, or maybe the, you know, your circulatory system or respiratory system, you know, just a lot of different metaphors there. But if you can, you know, picture that fractal network and how we try to reconcile all these seemingly different things. And in our lives, you know, a perfect example is just our biological genetics. I mean, we think, okay, well, if we trace it back, we've got two parents, four grandparents, eight great grandparents, and sometimes we have kitties who want attention, like the case is right now. but I always thought it was interesting that if you keep going back further and further, you run out of you know, you get up into billions of people, and you realize very quickly, it's like, well, how did this happen? Because now there's more people required to have contributed to my the genetics of this body that I think I am than have ever been on the planet. So
right.
there's a conundrum right there. I think the fractal nature, that, you know, the fragmentary nature, and the fact that we have all these networks of friends and things that we've learned, and a quick aside, about 20 years ago, I was in Egypt and had the distinct pleasure of hearing a talk by a rogue Egyptologist named John Anthony West. And he basically had a really fun experience where he was trying to, you know, convince the world that, you know, maybe the dynastic Egypt wasn't the be all end all as the, you know, the beginning of, you know, intelligent civilization in Egypt. And so his theory was that the Sphinx was a lot older than it was claimed to be. By, you know, more modern Egyptologists. And so what he did is he masked off a photo of the Sphinx that had massive amounts of water erosion and the hind quarter. So you really couldn't tell what it was. He handed this photo to a world-class geologist named Robert Schock. And Schock said, well, this is obviously the result of many millennia of water erosion, not knowing, you know, what this object
was.
and then he peeled off the mask and revealed, you know, the hindquarters and the front of the Sphinx. And he said, oh, like, oh, well, maybe we don't have the whole picture here, you know, because, you know, literally and figuratively, because what that implies is Egypt hasn't had massive amounts of rain and flooding and that sort of thing in many millennia. So that basically puts it way before pre-dynastic Egypt is when the Sphinx was built, and by association, perhaps the pyramids at the Giza complex. But again, you know, there's this the incredible. The point I was starting to make about West, which I thought was interesting, was that John Anthony West, his study into ancient Egypt suggested that in modern times, we study all these different subjects, but one of the points that kind of struck me as really being insightful was that I guess at least at one period, or maybe several stretches in Egypt's history, they went away from studying everything in isolation, but decided to study things as a whole, which really kind of speaks to the Course in Miracles principle of the idea of sameness being a gateway to oneness, and the multiplicity of seeming differences, if we can look and see what the sameness is with shared interest of, you know, what are we all trying to do? Well, we're trying to all wake up from the dream. That's the shared interest that the Course refers to. And so if we you know, gradually bring our mind back to oneness, we're essentially taking the ego's dark thread that goes into the deeper into the labyrinth and into darker and darker chasms, and taking that exact same thread which branches off. I mean, if you can picture a thread that is, you know, like branches of a tree fragmenting and then becoming smaller branches and then twigs and, you know, that sort of thing, going deeper and deeper into a, you know, a big cavernous maze or a labyrinth. And I know they're geometrically different, but they all can be gotten out of by just, interestingly enough, I learned this not too long ago. If you put your hand on one wall of a maze or a labyrinth, either one, even though they're geometrically different, and never take your hand off that one wall, you can always get out of it. It might take a long, long time,
but
you'll eventually get out. So I think that's a good metaphor for how we can, you know, by following the golden thread, which is really, as Ken points out in this wonderful audio, a transition in perspective, he says, you know, you can start by just taking wherever you're at, you know, grab a hold of that thread that by default ego makes a very dark and dreary and, you know, it's a you know, pretty desolate picture it paints. But if you turn it around, just basically, you know, grab it with your hand and face the other direction, it becomes a golden thread. And this exact same thread is just used for a different purpose. And that leads us out of the darkness, and it leads us at each branch, we come together and bring the tributaries together. We bring the branches together and see the sameness with the people in our lives and the circumstances in our lives, and we begin to generalize and see that, oh, there really is a common thread to not only what seems to have happened in my alleged life, but in everyone else's, and that we really are all here for the same purpose. We really are all here to you know, in the kindest way possible, to help each other wake up from this dream that we believe is true, this outer shield of oblivion that's a mask for the inner shield, which is the idea that somehow we committed a cosmic crime and pulled it off and shattered perfect oneness. Mm-hmm. And this hologram, you know, photorealistic Academy Award winning beyond, because it's you know, we just take this as gospel. We take this as the real deal, moment to moment. You know, the first thing we do in the morning when we wake up is like, okay, let's see, get this body out of bed, do some things, and, you know, again, back to those lists of, you know, whether they're written down or not. You know, we all have those itineraries of, you know, what we're going to spend our day doing, even if it's just doing nothing, that's still part of the itinerary.
Right. Well, and I'm not very far into the recordings. I mean, I don't know how many hours this particular workshop was. I've listened to a little more than an hour of it. But I'll tell you what I really noticed, or what kind of stopped me. And here again, maybe because I'm an astrologer and I'm thinking about, you know, so much of the Virgo energy right now, which is about habits and habitual behavior. But I'll tell you what I really thought is when he talks about, if you look at your life, and what are the stories that you tell? Because that's it. He keeps saying, you know, there's really only one thing. There's only one problem. And that is that you believe that you were separated. But the minute you thought that, then you create a whole cosmos to go along with that. You know, and in fact, the way he describes it, you can almost see it like a science fiction story. Because the minute that you thought this, then this whole thing unfolded. Mm-hmm. You know, every single possibility and those branches and tributaries and every possible combination of anything that could ever happen just unfolded, he says, like a carpet. But at the very same moment, there was the correction. At the very same moment, there was, in a sense, the golden thread to match that dark thread.
Exactly.
And he says, you know, look at your lives. And I don't even know that he says that kind of thing very often. At least it's the first time I heard him saying. But he says, really look at your life and just look at your patterns. He goes, you've been doing the same thing for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. And he keeps going on. 80 years, 90 years. He goes, look at it. You've got your patterns. You've got your story. And he said, and of course, what is your story? Your story is the same as everybody else's, which is, I am here, but it's not my fault. And anything that has ever happened to me, then I get to blame somebody. And, you know, he talks about listen to your story. And, you know, stop yourself and just say, what is your story? And what are the stories that you most like to tell? And this is what I think I really kind of got me. It put me in my place because he said, this, you know, we've got very selective memories. Just like perception is selective, so is memory.
Absolutely.
And when you remember your stories, and I think we probably all have favorite ones, and I could tell you my top five stories. You know, they're all about how I was the innocent victim of something. Or of someone. And he said, you know, but here's the thing, even if, you know, as you get older, you just get another version of the story. Mm-hmm. He goes, look at it. He goes, you know, as I was listening to that, I thought, oh my God, he's right. You know,
yeah.
We have a combination of stories and we think they're different, but no, it's our story of victimization. You know, in one way or another, why we're not accountable, why we are not responsible. We're here, but it's not our fault. Or what's happened is not our fault. But if you look around, everybody's got that story. Everybody's got that story.
Exactly.
You know, so that, like I said, that's going to keep me busy for at least a few weeks. Really, really, well, it is.
Yeah.
Just thinking about that and thinking about the need to be identified with my story, you know, because we live for that. You know, that's what keeps the ego thriving. That's what keeps the ego moving is the story.
And the word story is so revealing because it's made up.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fiction, but we've adopted such, I wouldn't necessarily say gullible, but our minds are so powerful, I think it'd probably be a better way of saying it, that we are capable of believing the story we made up and actually have the audacity the arrogance to actually believe that this story is true. And I think that arrogance speaks to, you know, the Course's idea of the atonement, which is really, you know, being willing to consider in true humility that our story isn't working for us, that you know, all these branches of the story, and like you say, all the, you know, you mentioned you could think of like five or, you know, half a dozen, whatever, different, you know, primary victimizers or whatever, you know, the episodes in your story that usually involve some kind of projection or finger pointing that suggests that we're not responsible. And of course, the self that we've identified with so thoroughly as the storybook character that, you know, you call CA, I call Bruce, and other, you know, whoever's listening calls, you know, you insert your name here kind of thing. Those stories are fictitious. And if we can just begin to consider that they're made up and that they're, you know, like if Helen Bill said, you know, there must be a better way, then, you know, there could be another interpretation that doesn't make this dream of a world the focal point, the primary identity for ourselves. And I think it takes looking at each of those individual stories, like you were suggesting, and, you know, as they come up, as things remind us of those stories, you know, whether it's, you know, people that we meet or, you know, family get-togethers or, you know, talking with friends or coworkers or, you know, things on TV or on the web or whatever, you know, whatever reminds us, something we're reading that says, oh, that reminds me of when I was involved in such and such. And if we can think of that as, you know, part of the labyrinth, part of the story, part of the maze of this incredibly complex system, thought system that's designed to keep us mindless, designed to keep us fixated on the form instead of on the content in the mind, which is am I not only, you know, bringing the story back into the present, regurgitating it and swallowing it again. You know, pardon the metaphor, but we keep, you know, coming up with seemingly new variations that, if we are honest and look at them, it's like it's all the same thing. It's all the same thread. It's all the same content. And there's only, you know, really two ways of looking at it. We can look at it from the ego's perspective that keeps us in a victim or victimizer. Either one achieves the same result of you know, the guilty, sinful, fearful, separated self. Or we can, you know, just turn our hand the other direction and grab the thread and walk out of the cave instead of deeper into it, and have all those tributaries come together rather than splitting apart. And then it keeps glowing brighter and brighter as we follow that same thread, which now, instead of a dark, dismal thread, becomes a golden thread that we follow out of the labyrinth. And that, you know, the character in, you know, the protagonist in the Greek myth was named Ariadne. And interestingly enough, I think we might have talked about this movie before, Inception, uses that name for the character who builds the labyrinth of the dreams for the plot in that movie. And there's a tie in there that I thought was kind of interesting when it came out. And on subsequent viewings of that film, which, you know, if it's not a kid's film, but if you want a film that's got some really interesting symbolism, I think it's loaded with it, which includes, you know, the authority problem aspect, mm-hmm. of you know, challenging the father figure and listening to an alternate voice that basically creates a different story, and then levels of dreaming, and there's a whole bunch in that film. But the whole premise is that, you know, that our minds are creating this vast labyrinth, and we're, you know, in different levels of dreaming and different depths in the cave and on and on. It's just a great metaphor for how involved we've all become in the specifics and the specialness that the specifics bring, and fixating on those individual, seemingly separate things and people and stuff and our stories within those that rivets us and anchors us to the dark thread if we identify with the specifics as being, particularly as being, the determiners of our state of mind, you know, getting the cart before the horse and putting things backwards, where we think that somehow the circumstances determine our peace or lack of it, instead of realizing that it's our choice of thought systems that determine how we see everything that seems to be happening in our stories.
That's right. Because, you know, and of course, this is just another way of saying, who are you listening to? Are you listening to the ego, or are you listening to your right mind, or whether you call it the Holy Spirit or Jesus or whatever it is? And it comes right back to every single thing in our life is part of the classroom and part of our curriculum, and specifically our relationships. In fact, in this series, you know, Ken once again says, don't ignore or deny your relationships.
Exactly.
That's your textbook. That's mm-hmm. what you're doing. And in fact, he says a couple of things that I was laughing at myself, because he says something like, you can't hopscotch your way from this world into heaven. and you know, I thought this was funny too, because I think it's a football metaphor. He goes, you can't do an end run,
uh-huh.
you know? And I thought, oh my God, I was laughing at myself, because I thought that's exactly what I try to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, it's like, okay, there's a way to create this peace of mind by just not associating with that person, or let's just not be part of that relationship. And so I, you know, I just laughed at myself when I saw that, and especially the hopscotch thing,
right.
You know, that, and I guess there again, because we see ourselves as being able to do something like, well, if I meditate, or if I do this certain ritual, then I really can do that end run to heaven, and I don't have to work through these relationships, or I don't have to work through this curriculum. And, you know, he even addresses that. He goes, it's now or later, you're going to do it one way or another. You can put one relationship behind you, or you can deny it, or you can ignore the lessons. He goes, but this is your story, and you're going to just keep telling it over and over and over until you look at it and use it as your curriculum, use it as your textbook.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, darn, once again, Ken, you know, that's exactly what I want to do, is hopscotch my way to heaven.
Nailed us again, huh? Yeah. If it was just a matter of reciting the right mantra, or you know, striking the right yoga pose, or having the perfect amorous experience, or culinary
Yes.
experience, or job, or partners,
Crystals and oils
coworkers.
and you, yeah.
Whatever. Anything that has space, time, or individuality is sort of my big three. In the GIST acronym, the guilt, individuality, space, time. I figure if any of those are involved, I'm barking up the wrong tree again. So that, yeah, like you say, the relationships is huge, and that's really, it's not just relationships with people, it's relationships with animals, with the plant kingdom, with the mineral kingdom, all the things that are seem to be fragments in our hierarchies of differences.
Does that include skunks? Do I have to have a relationship with the neighborhood skunks? Really?
I think that sounds like it could be a recurring theme, huh?
It's one of my recurring themes.
Well, yeah, and since I alluded to the fact that I'm next week I'm going across the country, a few states over to for a sabbatical. I'm and I mentioned this before we started the recording. I'm very cognizant of the fact when I'm more lucid. That all the issues or whatever that I have in this current state, they're not going anywhere because they're projections of my mind. So if I think that somehow, changing geography, just like changing jobs, relationships, whatever, pick anything that's specific in the world, is going to change anything without changing my thoughts about it, I'm fooling myself. I mean,
Right.
how could it be otherwise? How could it be
Right.
otherwise?
And you said something earlier that I think is also really important that Ken mentions in this series, and that is your special relationships aren't just those intimate relationships. He goes, this can be the projections that you put onto public figures.
Oh,
He
sure.
goes, that's your special relationship. When you have that strong emotion tied to a public figure, good or bad or ugly, and so he says that, it's a special relationship with anything in this world that you think is in this world, and including your own body.
Oh, yes.
And because that's it, you're projecting one way or the other. So now it's my body that's my enemy, or it's this person. Or if, in fact, at one point he says, people want to say it's my DNA or it's my genes or it's my family. And he goes, what family? What genes? This is an illusion.
Exactly,
There are
exactly.
no families.
Right.
And so it's just our way of, classifying what we think our target enemy is, or whoever it is that we can blame, and that they're going to be responsible for what we don't like,
And a good reminder for people, particularly who are new to the course, is he's not saying, deny that you have a family or deny that you have, any particular relationship in the world, but the denial, the proper use of denial that the course addresses, A Course in Miracles addresses, is denying the power of specifics to affect one's peace of mind, and the way to do that properly is basically to choose the thought system of kindness that basically says, yeah, I'll let me do what I can do to make this dream of a world better is to the best of my ability, but at the same time not take it seriously in the sense that my identity does not have to be appendage to or dependent on anything specific that's happening or not happening in the world. And
Right.
I'm glad you mentioned the body, because that's one's own body, because that's usually a massive source of special relationships, particularly as these alleged bodies get older and have more and more issues. And but how could we possibly, if the idea that we are spirit is true, then the body that we seem to be inhabiting at any given moment, if that really is, as physics tells us, just a collection of probability states, in a bunch of atoms that are conceptual ideas that were made up by a mind. Now this is where physics, hasn't quite got there yet. A mind made mad by guilt. If that's what the course suggests, that by default, if the world is really an attack on God, then that's the dark thread. That's the the special relationships that lead us further and further into the cave. And, you know, there's more blood spattered on the walls of that cave, you know, the deeper we go into it, because we're the anger and the fear and the grievances and the victimhood gets more and more entrenched. The deeper we go into that cave of, you know, the believing that we're separate. And yet all we have to do is turn it around and moment to moment say, why am I here? You know, what am I doing in this specific situation? How can I make it about the other person? How can I be inclusive? How can I think in terms of what would be the kindest thing? And that really just puts us in touch with the golden thread that heals any specific relationships. And as you pointed out very appropriately, that, you know, we need all those specific relationships in order to undo the dream. We need every single thing that comes up in front of our faces, Gary Renard's teachers say, that, you know, as our forgiveness classroom, moment to moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, something that you said towards the beginning of this conversation, I think, is another way to look at this is, what is the purpose?
Yeah.
Because just as, you know, when Ken was saying, you know, there are no families, there are no genes, but he said, but there are purposes.
Right.
And are you using this for a purpose? And you are. So is your purpose to maintain ego, to maintain separation, to maintain a sense of being able to judge and attack? Or is your purpose to awake from the dream?
Right.
You know, you're either going one way or the other, which is another way of talking about the dark thread or the golden thread.
Mm-hmm.
What is your purpose? And it's not the thing. It's not the projection. It's the purpose that you give it. And in any single moment, you can change the purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we've all noticed that, you know, when you're in the thick of something and you're, you know, having it out with, you know, somebody in your life or, you know, yelling at the TV, or, you know, a few moments ago when you were talking about, you know, the inanimate objects, the video clip that came to mind was a favorite one from Fawlty Towers, where John Cleese, as the inept innkeeper, doesn't believe his staff has the capacity to put on a nice gourmet night for the hotel guests. So he on the sly hires a chef across town, and he's collected this fabulous dish under a giant silver platter, loaded into his little tiny car. Of course, Cleese is like six, you know,
yeah,
six and a half something, and he's squeezing
yeah.
it. And halfway across town, getting back to his hotel with this dish, his car, you know, conks out, and he starts cursing at the car like that's going to help, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then to further, I'll have to send you the clip if you haven't seen it. But to further,
I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's hilarious! It's hilarious. And to further emphasize the folly, you know, he's cursing and, you know, is on, this is in the early days when, you know, there wasn't much colorful language, but he was using it about as potent a language as he could at the time. And so the camera still is focused on the car as he walks away from the car. And then a few seconds later, he comes back with a tree branch and starts thrashing the car as if that's going to, you know, further help the car get going again. But that's kind of what we do. You know, we think that if we condemn or in some way criticize or judge or berate or, you know, use our blame thrower basically to say, well, it's something outside of me that's the problem here. You know, we're forgetting that you know, we made the car. We made the entire story, not on the level of the personal self, but on the level of the mind that the course addresses, which is the completely inclusive mind that we think we've fragmented out into these little separate minds. And that's why we, you know, the cave metaphor and the labyrinth metaphor is such a great one, because the self that we think we are is way down in the deep recesses of this, you know, mine shaft, dark kind of place, you know, where we think we're going to find some treasure there. And when we get it out to the light, we realize, oh, that was fool's gold, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I have a line that I say to myself, and unfortunately, I say it quite often, and it's just physics.
Uh-huh.
And what I mean by that is, I find myself getting angry at an inanimate object.
Uh-huh.
That, as if, you know, because the door isn't shutting correctly or whatever it is. And somehow I'm taking it very personally. you know, and it, and so I'll shove it harder or whatever. And, you know, oftentimes I just think, you know, it's sort of like, no, just back up. The reason it's not shutting is, did you notice there's something stuck in it?
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just physics. And so instead of trying to use brute force and to make something happen the way I want it to, and like I said, I'm talking about physical things, you know, it's sort of like all of a sudden just say, okay, why isn't the door closing? Or what is going on that this, you know, that won't stay on the hook or whatever it is. And I just find myself, I'm taking it so personally, I just back up and I go, see, it's just physics.
Right.
Now
right.
just stop and take a look at what's going on here. There's a reason. There's a shoe in the door. There's something going on here. So just use your head instead of trying to push this. And, you know, and I find myself doing it. I do. And I kind of blame it on the Aries in my chart, you know, because it's just like I can push my head down and just move through something, you know.
I am through it. Huh?
But it's so funny because later, I mean, if somebody would watch me do that, they'd go, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're not even looking at the nature of the thing. You know, it's not being bad. It's not being against you. It's simply doing what it physically has to do. So that's what I call it. When I stop myself, I go, see, it's just physics.
Yeah. Well, so now you can
physics,
use that.
It's not personal.
Now you can use that phrase as a trigger phrase to remind yourself that's like, oh, I can be mindful instead of mindless and look at the cause, which is always in the mind, and realize, oh, I could see peace instead of this. I could choose a different teacher.
I could go for the golden thread.
Yeah.
I changed the purpose here.
Exactly.
What yeah, concept.
as you were saying that, I was thinking of a movie I was watching the other evening this guy who keeps banging into, you know, an old TV and try to get the fuzzy picture to clear up, you know, and thinking that, you know, repeated blows from the fist on the top of the set is going to be the optimal solution kind of thing, you know.
Right.
But that's, you know, that's kind of the kind of distorted logic that we all use. And I think that's another important thing to remember is that ego's logic, although it's, you know, insane, is completely consistent.
Because it's single-minded.
Yeah, it basically says I'm consistently going to reject anything that has to do with the mind as a cause. I'm going to consistently reject anything that has to do with the idea that the guilt that I'm not wanting to look at is the, you know, the cause of what seems to be happening in my world, and I, you know, and that's why it made this you know double shield of oblivion, this outer shield that says, oh, as long as I keep my mind preoccupied with stuff happening in the world, I don't have to look at my mind. And then once we break through that and say, well, gee, you know, maybe I could actually, you know, think about what my real options are, and it has nothing to do with, you know, illusion A or illusion B or illusion C. It has to do with, do I want to identify with the illusions? That's what the chapter 31 section on the real alternative keeps gently reminding us to do is to, rather than going down all these labyrinthine pathways and diversions, just follow the golden thread out, and that's the real alternative. That's the one, choosing the thought system that gives us the capacity to choose against the sin, guilt, fear, craziness that's consistently 100% insane, even if it's, you know, it's consistent, but it's just consistently insane.
Right. Well, and before we leave this conversation, I want to mention one other thing that Ken said too. And like I said, I'm only through the first hour. I think there's still maybe 4 or 5 hours left in this series. So I'm looking forward to that. But he mentions, and I don't remember now if it's lesson 135 or lesson 136, but he makes the comment that while you made plans for death, the Holy Spirit gently led you to eternal life.
Exactly.
And, you know, he does make a point of saying, hey, but no, wait a minute. You know, it's not as though the Holy Spirit is a chess master. He's not planning or arranging your life. But just that while you were off being obsessed with your purpose, you know, there was always this other purpose there. There was always an alternative. And, you know, that alternative is always going to be there. And I'll tell you what it kind of, you know, reminds me of. And I don't have a direct experience, so I'm really making this up. But it's almost like What I could see in my mind is like a kid throwing a temper tantrum. And while the kid's throwing the temper tantrum, the mother is in the kitchen making, a sandwich, or she's getting a glass of milk, or she's just doing something nice, knowing that eventually the child is going to get over the temper tantrum and she's going to go, "Okay, come on in and have some cookies and milk." And that's kind of what I saw when, that when while we're making plans for death, while we're, making our lists and checking them twice and crossing everything off and making all these, continuing to tell our story and making up new stories, here's this other alternative that's always there, the milk and cookies, and it's like eventually we're going to quit throwing the temper tantrum and we're going to come in and have some milk and cookies, I could just kind of see that. And it's like, once again, it's a feeling I get with A Course in Miracles so often, which is, just like, oh, okay, just like settling into this kind of energy of it doesn't have to be such a fight.
It doesn't. It can be a gentle, easy process whereby we just look at the things that are happening, this, and use the specifics that are coming up for us at any given moment, and realize, oh, this is my perfect forgiveness opportunity. I can forgive the dreamer for assigning blame, for assigning irritation, assigning the belief in separation to this specific. And when I disinvest myself from that identity, and using that specific as the perfect classroom curriculum, I'm following the golden thread and falling back out of the cave and into the light.
It's wonderful. This, like I said, I am just so impressed with this whole series that's called A Transition in Perspective by Ken Wapnick. So thank you for suggesting it. And I have a feeling there's going to be a lot more conversations based, because like I said, we kind of barely scratched the first hour of this workshop.
I think we could pick it up again. And there was also that section in chapter 16 that talks about it briefly, but we could do that, and maybe in a subsequent
Yeah, we
conversation.
will do that, because this is a wonderful thing, and other people may want to check it out too. But before you go today, do you have any announcements you'd like to make?
Yeah, I would have one announcement, and that is on October 16th through the 18th, there's going to be a virtual conference on A Course in Miracles that's put on by the MiracleShare.org folks. If you go to acimblog.com, you will see a link for that. And I'm one of the two dozen plus participants in that. It's a 3-day conference, and there's a half-hour video, either a monologue or a conversation that's recorded, followed by a half-hour live Q&A on the phone with all the participants. So if you weren't part of that yet last year, you can still follow the link to listen to all of last year's 3 days worth of presentations and commentary, and then also participate in this year's, which starts October 16th. So,
Okay, great. So it starts October 16th.
And
All
it
right,
goes 3 days.
great. All right. Well, Bruce, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, CA. I
And
really
I
enjoyed the
look,
conversation.
yeah, me too. And I look forward to other conversations.
Likewise.
And good luck with your move.
Thanks.
Okay. You've been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks here on 1-2 Radio. And that was my guest, Bruce Rawls. And we've been talking about a series of recordings that were workshops that were done by Ken Wapnick and that I think actually were released, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. And it's called A Transition in Perspective. And in fact, what I'm going to do right after the show is I will put a link to the online bookstore at the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, where you can check out these recordings if you're interested in hearing them for yourself. I don't know, we may be playing maybe portions of them in the weeks ahead. I don't know, we'll have to see about that. But these I have found to be very powerful, and they might be something you would want to check out for yourself. So I want to just say once again, thanks to Bruce, and thanks to all the listeners who are here today, and thanks to everybody who was making comments in the chat room and participating that way. And thanks to our producer, Scott Weaver. You can find me for readings, personal consultations, mentoring, and coaching on 12listen.com. And you can also find me every Tuesday on my other show, Simple Tales. I'm live every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific and 2 Eastern. If you have comments about the course, or, if you have topics that you'd like us to talk about or questions that you would like to have addressed on the air, please email me at simpletales@comcast.net. So that's simpletales, just like it sounds, at comcast.net. You have about 5 minutes before the next live show, which is The Through Line with Christine Dumaurier. And I hope you'll keep it tuned to 1-2 Radio today, where we have lots of live programming and wonderful shows coming up for you. So thanks for being here. Until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You've been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks and my guest, Bruce Rawls, on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality. This is psychic astrologer C.A. Brooks with your cosmic weather report for September. Expansive Jupiter is settling into cool, calm, and collected Virgo. I'm itching to learn something new. How about you? Venus, the planet of love, is finishing a 6-week retrograde pattern in dramatic Leo, just in time for Mercury, the planet of thinking and communication, to start its own retrograde in Libra. Saturn, the great manifester, is grabbing the headlines too, as the planet of organization and discipline meets its match in freedom-loving Sagittarius. Just like Charles Lindbergh, who was the first man to fly across the Atlantic Ocean during a previous Saturn and Sagittarius cycle, do you have dreams that you want to see get off the ground? If all this astrology talk sounds like Greek to you, it doesn't have to. When you know the basics of astrology vocabulary and you learn the four basic building blocks, signs, planets, houses, and aspects, you can unlock the world of the zodiac. On September 3rd, I'm teaching that very thing, Astrology Basics, a 12-week series in which you will learn everything you need to know. When you sign up for Astrology Basics, you will get a comprehensive handout before each class and a recording of the session afterwards. You can take the recording and the handout with you on a walk, to the beach, and listen whenever you want to, as many times as you like. Learning astrology and taking classes on 1-2 Academy has never been easier. If Jupiter in Virgo is inspiring the desire to go back to school and learn something new and open up new worlds for you, I hope you will consider Astrology Basics on 1-2 Academy. Thursday nights, starting September 3rd. This is C.A. Brooks encouraging you to keep it tuned to 1-2 Radio. For more up-to-date information about the Cosmic Weather Report and everything metaphysical and spiritual, we are changing the way you think about the world.